From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. From day one of her tenure as head of the Environmental Protection Agency, it was anything but smooth sailing for Christy Todd Whitman. After 28 months as the nation's top environmental administrator, yesterday she resigned. The former New Jersey governor and moderate Republican tried to keep both oars in the water, attempting to strike a near impossible pro-environment, pro-business balance in the Bush-era EPA. She ended up bruised and bad-mouthed by lobbyists on both sides, with her own boss landing some of the hardest blows. President Bush backed out of a campaign promise on carbon emissions and out of the Kyoto Treaty. Then came the flap over arsenic in drinking water and more. Secretary of State Colin Powell once described her as the Bush administration wind dummy, blithely thrown out the window to test the gales. With her resignation, Christy Todd Whitman leaves behind a checkered environmental legacy and even bigger questions about the future of environmental protection under George W. Bush. Tonight, we're sketching an environmental impact statement on the Bush administration and the Christy Todd Whitman years. How do you rate the Bush bearing on the national environment, on the world's? Did Christy Todd Whitman fight the good fight, or did she fumble? Is there a real place for a pro-environment agency in this pro-business administration? And is federal regulation the most effective protection for the environment, or is there a better way? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Eric Pianin. He covers the environment for The Washington Post. Good evening and welcome, Eric Pianin.
Good evening, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. Eric, take us into the bushes here. Why exactly is Christy Todd Whitman leaving?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons. One, her stated reason, which is that she's sort of tired of the Washington scene, misses her husband, and wants to go back to New Jersey.
Her house plants are not enough for company, she said, and we can all understand that, but there's a bigger context here.
Well, I think there's a lot bigger context, and I think you touched on a number of those points in your opening remarks. I mean, from the start, Whitman had the unenviable role of being a moderate Republican in charge of environmental policy in a conservative administration that is chiefly concerned about economic growth, domestic energy production, and reducing regulatory controls, far less about the niceties of environmental protection. She had a very rough time of it during her first year in Washington, and she frequently lost out in high-profile disputes with the White House and the Energy Department on, you know, issues ranging from global warming and clean air to water quality. There's been much speculation, really, for the past year or so that she was on her way out. I think to her credit, she hung in there and gradually asserted herself more and achieved some important victories at a time when the president's attention was shifting to issues of war and terrorism.
Eric, give us a sense of the pressure of the lobbyists and ideologues around Christy Todd Whitman in the Bush administration. How conscious was she of being circled by powers, by people who did not share her view of the environment?
Right. Well, President Bush once told her at a cabinet meeting that she has probably the worst job in the administration, and it's essentially a no-win proposition. Nothing that she could do would totally satisfy the environmental groups, you know, who had sort of high hopes for her when she came in and had these expectations that she was going to sort of moderate the administration's policies and make some real headway on the environment. In fact, regardless of what she did, it was criticized by them. And on the other hand, she was dealing with industry groups that had a pipeline into the Energy Department and the White House who were pressuring her to go further in reducing the regulations that they said were discouraging investment and expansion investment in utilities and energy production.
Right. Eric, Christy Todd Whitman was very gracious in her letter of resignation and in all of her comments in the last day and a half since she put that forward. She'll be going soon. But was she, did she talk with reporters? Do you have a sense that she had the full awareness that she was in a full body contact sport when she stepped into this administration with an environmental brief?
You know, I don't think she ever fully realized what she was walking into. And I think she made the point in her farewell meeting with reporters the other day that she was stunned, really, by some of the vehement reaction to some of the administration's policies. I think the best example of that was when the administration announced that it was going to challenge or reconsider a Clinton administration rule that would toughen the standard for arsenic in drinking water. You probably remember that.
Sure.
And it was part of the administration's overall reassessment of a lot of the last-minute rulemaking by Clinton.
It was very costly for some municipalities to meet these low arsenic levels, and the Bush administration said, hey, let's loosen this up a little bit.
Precisely. And there was such a firestorm of protest, and the environmental groups seized on it, and they ridiculed Bush and Whitman for trying to poison the waters, you know. They circulated, some of the environmental groups circulated bottled water with a label Presidential Springs tap water.
Arsenic, made a good, brutal headline, and it was used to the maximum.
Exactly. And, you know, she was stunned by this and realized that was probably the biggest mistake she made. Because
was she naive? Was she used by this administration?
Well, I mean, I don't know that a former seven-year governor of New Jersey is necessarily naive.
Seems unlikely, and yet.
But I do think that she was brought in part to put a moderate, environmental-friendly face on an administration that was committed clearly to energy production. That was their primary goal and issue shortly after they came in. Remember, Vice President Cheney headed up the whole energy task force.
Right, and so much for limits on carbon emission and out with Kyoto and off we go.
You know, we were in an energy crisis. And so on the one hand, she was trying to, moderate views to some extent, although you've got to keep in mind that, you know, she was her background is one of sort of advocate of business-friendly environmental policies back in New Jersey. She had sort of a mixed record there, and the environmentalists said that she was good on, you know, land conservation,
right,
but lousy on water pollution. And
but that was a setting where the notion of balance between business and environment seemed to be realized in some sense. Here she seemed to have a tougher time finding that. What about the next step here, Eric Pienen? We're heading into a new campaign season. There will need to be a new director of the Environmental Protection Agency. Do you imagine the Bush administration going again for someone that will look moderate, or is it gloves off time? What are the names out there as possible successors to Christy Todd Whitman?
Well, I think that, the White House is stressing that they have no one in mind yet, although several names have been circulating.
Such as?
Including David Strews, who's the Secretary of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, Jeb Bush's Environmental Secretary.
This is the brother-in-law of Andy Card, White House Chief of Staff.
Right. Josephine Cooper, Chief Operating Officer of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers.
Chief Operating Officer of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers to be head of the EPA.
Right. That's a trade association of light car,
we can imagine,
car and light truck manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And some have even mentioned John Engler, the former Michigan governor who was no friend of the environmentalists, that's for sure.
So do any of these look like moderates, or are these more, let's go business?
Well, I think Strews actually is probably the most moderate of the group. And in some ways, his choice would be not all that dissimilar from Christy Todd Whitman. Mm.
Eric Pienen, stand by if you would. I want to invite into our conversation Brent Blackwelder. He's joining us also from Washington, D.C. tonight. He's president of Friends of the Earth. He's been an environmental advocate in Washington for over 30 years. Good evening and welcome, Brent Blackwelder.
Yes, I'm glad to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Brent Blackwelder, how do you sum up the I guess brief is too short, but long is too long, the tenure of Christy Todd Whitman?
Well, we at Friends of the Earth thought that she should have resigned in the spring of the first year after President Bush said we're going to re-examine the arsenic standard, and that we're not going to adhere to the campaign pledge to reduce global warming emissions. And we likened it to the situation back in the Nixon administration when Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, said, I will not fire the special prosecutor. It is against my principles. She could have made it clear that she wanted to be in charge. Instead, she initiated a regime of at EPA of just simply stepping back and deferring to what the administration wanted to do.
So, in your view, not the honorable thing?
No, and we said she should have stepped aside at that point.
What was Chrissy Todd Whitman's reply to that kind of call?
No, she was going to stick it out and guts it out, but I think proof positive is in the fact that, okay, so they wanted to revisit the arsenic standard, and they commissioned the National Academy of Sciences, and they came back with a science that said it should actually be lower than what Clinton did. Instead of 10 parts per billion, it should be 3. But they didn't go ahead then with 3. They said, okay, Clinton's fine.
Brent Blackwelder, top line here, how do you see the environmental needle in the United States short-term and long, having moved in the last 28 months, Chrissy Todd Whitman's tenure?
Well, I think if you look at all of the Bush appointees having anything to do with environment, that she was probably the best of that lot. But what we were saying is we have experienced an administrator that has fundamentally presided over the weakening of three fundamental cornerstones of environmental protection, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the toxic dump legislation, so-called Superfund law.
And with that, what happens to the EPA? Can the EPA operate effectively in a Republican administration with the kind of attitude toward business that this one has, or is that simply impossible?
Well, it's especially difficult because the current administration has asked for a 40% cut in programs at EPA dealing with clean water and drinking water.
So, with less budget,
to operate with
less budget, less to be done. Eric Pienin, what's the sense that you're getting there on the EPA itself? Can it find a balance in this administration that will appease at least environmentalists while it works for the business community, or is that simply impossible in this era?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty hard to satisfy Brent's group or most of the other environmental groups. I think a lot of times the critics will paint the administration in very stark tones, usually very in a very negative way. The reality is that it's a mixed bag, and there have been some. There have been some initiatives that environmentalists would applaud, including the recent proposed rule for slashing off-road diesel emissions by as much as 95% in the coming decade. The administration pushed through brownfields legislation. They're forcing GE to pay for the cleanup of the Hudson River. And there's been a recent series of settlements with major utilities in Virginia, Wisconsin, and elsewhere. Under the Clean Air Act, new source review program. So, I mean, you can point to some successes, if you will, for the environmentalists, and there's a lot of stuff, particularly this whole effort to do away with the new source review program, the administration's Clear Skies initiative, which a lot of the environmentalists think is less, would do less in the long run than just vigorously enforcing the existing Clean Air Act. There's a big controversy over a lot of it, but I don't think it's you can paint it all black or white.
Brent Blackwelder, we've just got a few seconds before the break here, but well, is there texture to this picture?
Well, I would just simply say it's not a question of what environmental groups want. What we want is for the health of our families. That, for me, is the most important thing that I'm concerned about. And I think that's what the American public wants. It's not whether they're pleasing Friends of the Earth or the Sierra Club or any other group. Is, are they doing the right thing to protect our families? Are they improving air and water quality in our cities? Or are we coming down with more cases of asthma, more people dying prematurely?
We're going to come back and look at all of it. We've got to take a short break.
Those are the questions.
Eric Pianin, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Eric Pianin is staff writer for The Washington Post, covers the environmental beat. We're talking tonight about Christy Todd Whitman and the environmental impact of the Bush administration. What's the Christy Todd Whitman environmental legacy? What is the Bush enviro legacy so far? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Christy Todd Whitman and the environmental impact of the Bush administration. The director of the EPA announced yesterday that she will resign after 28 months there. Is there room for real environmental protection in a real pro-business administration? Is there an effective alternative to government regulation in protecting the environment? And if Christy Todd Whitman was too green for the Bush White House, what comes next? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Brent Blackwelder, joining us from Washington. He's president of Friends of the Earth. And now also from Washington by John Dineen. He's editor of Congressional Green Sheets, an independent publishing company that provides information on congressional action on the environment, energy, and natural resources. Good evening and welcome, John Dineen.
Nice to be with you tonight.
It's great to have you. John Dineen, take us, if you would, into the heart of what looks like an ideological confrontation in the Bush administration, in some part played out in the Christy Todd Whitman story. Green as she was, or pro-business as she wasn't pro-business enough for the Bush administration. What's the new dynamic that's come in these last 28 months to the executive branch and their view of the environment?
Well, I'm not entirely sure it's a new dynamic. When the Clinton administration was in power, there were a large number of Republicans on the Hill who were deeply hostile to a lot of the regulatory programs that the Clinton administration was carrying out. So there's nothing new in that respect. The Bush administration came in, and they fully expected that a lot of those what they regarded as regulatory excesses by the Clinton administration would be reversed under the Bush administration.
I guess it's just new that it's in the White House now. And what is that view? Is it simply that, is this an extension of the kind of free market view of the world, that the environment should be sorted out by market forces and government should not be regulating it? Or is it more focused on maximizing profit? How do you describe it?
I think the argument that that the administration would bring to the table is that what they would call command and control is not the best approach to this. They would argue that, in fact, all sides always say the same thing, mm-hmm. that all of our goals are the same. It's a cleaner air, it's cleaner water, it's a better environment for our families. Also, the Clinton administration and the Bush administration both say that there is no conflict between the economy and the environment. Now, both sides say the other doesn't really mean that.
Mm-hmm.
Bush people are quite sure that the approach taken by the Clinton people is damaging to the economy.
That is, the Clinton people said they were for business, but in the end of the day, they just stick up for the environment and business be damned. And the Democrats or environmentalists saying the Bush people claim they're for the environment, but business rules ultimately.
That is what they would say. Now, the Bush people would say they've got a better way, which is you can use market forces to accomplish the same things environmentally that you were trying to accomplish by command and control.
And what's an example of how that might work, John Dineen?
Well, the approach that it first came into the fore was on acid rain, when they started using a cap-and-trade program, which said we're no longer going to set individual emissions limits for each plant. We're going to set overall limits. And then you can, if you have a better way of reducing those emissions, you can do that, or you can buy essentially the right to pollute, mm-hmm. so that you allow the economy to sort out the most effective and economic way to achieve an overall reduction. The Bush administration would bring that to a wider array of environmental programs.
Brent Blackwelder, come in here. Are you representing an outmoded view of the world that's command and control and that won't really work long term for the environment? Is it better to let market forces loose with the kind of trading of emissions and so on that John Dineen is describing?
Well, fundamentally, we have been one of the leaders in terms of using market forces such as the tax code, and yet the Bush administration will not renew the Superfund tax on the polluters to clean up toxic waste dumps. They've cut those cleanups in half, and the tax on the polluters has expired. So making the people responsible is not on their in their game plan, and yet that market force, that market mechanism that most businesses like has been neglected. A second thing is that the Bush administration is not pro-business. They are pro-oil and chemical industry, but they are anti-green business, they are anti-wind power, they are anti-solar, they are anti-energy efficiency. So, yes, if you want the polluters to prevail, this is your man, the Bush administration.
John Dineen, there's a pretty hard reply, but it does raise something interesting. How does the kind of the market forces that that we're just talking about here, how might they deal with a Superfund toxic waste dump?
Well, no one really knows the answer to that, because Brent describes a situation now where there was a tax that was put on certain industries to bring in money for Superfund, and in fact, under Superfund, those who are responsible are supposed to pay for the cleanup, and the Superfund tax money is supposed to also provide funding for cleanup. That tax has been has not been renewed for years now. The Superfund has, I don't know the exact figure, but there's little, if any, money left. So now that you have taxpayers themselves paying for these cleanups. So I don't know that this is a case where I'm not sure it's market forces per se. No. I mean, beyond making industry responsible for the cleanup of hazardous waste that they're connected with in any way.
Which might take a little command and control. John, can you just tick off for us right down through the categories here, if there is consensus on how things are going, air, water, wetlands, has there been a change of direction of significant regulation in the past 2 years in air quality, water quality, wetland protection? Is it headed up, down, or stable?
Oh, I imagine you can get any answer you want depending on which side you're on. I mean, the flashpoints in the environment over the past, since the Bush administration has come in is clean air, because of the their clear skies proposal would differ substantially from what Democrats and many environmentalists would prefer to do,
and loosen regulations on emissions there.
Put in these caps that environmentalists argue will result in less clean air than would have been under the current. Is that fair to say, Brent? Am I getting that right?
Brent Blackwelder?
Yes. Well, what I would say is that the administration has fundamentally let everybody down. They say they're for business, but they're only for a certain select group of businesses. They're not for market mechanisms, because they will not utilize the tax on toxic waste dump.
We've got that, Brent, but what about if you look at specific categories? If you look at air, has the direction that the country's going changed for the better or worse?
The official EPA statistics show that our water quality is actually getting worse. It's worsened. So why should we, 25 years after the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972, not have the 80 or 90% of our water is fishable and swimmable? Instead, we've got them loaded with mercury. Fish advisories are being issued, and the amount of bodies of water, rivers, lakes, and streams that are not fit for swimming, not fit for fishing, has increased.
But you can't lay all that on the Bush. Can you lay all that on the Bush administration? I mean, these are long-term factors, aren't they?
It means that we are not being effective. We are not moving forward where the public has said we want to be.
Brent Blackwelder, John Dineen, stand by. I want to invite our callers in. Hans is calling from Oregon, Wisconsin. Hi, Hans. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
The point I would like to make is I think most of our national conversation about the environment is skewed. It's my contention that Americans do 90 to 95% of their voting on the environment with their dollars. We do it with our dollars.
So are you saying, Hans, that it doesn't matter who's the head of the EPA, it doesn't matter who's in the White House, it's all...
I'm saying that I think President Bush actually represents Americans very well because of the way we're acting. We buy big SUVs, we throw all kinds of chemicals on our lawns, and then the water quality goes down.
And here's a president who's...
Every time we turn around, we're inventing ways to consume more and more of everything, and energy in particular. The energy, we give all kinds of money at the gas pump. These guys show up and call the shots in Washington.
Hans, we've got it, and thanks for your point. Let me put it to Brent Blackwelder. Brent, you were saying that Americans want higher quality air, water, and the rest, but our caller says, look at the way we live, we consume. We're not voting, in fact, with our lives and our lifestyles.
In some cases, there's a real disconnect between what people say in the polls and then what they do with their purchasing power. What we do know is that people say that clean water is vital to them, and they are really concerned about the health of their families. But what is not done, because we have green scamming, is that candidates and officials try to portray themselves as in favor of environmental protection when they're actually coached on how to use code words like clear skies, healthy forest, and they're in favor of weakening protections.
And that's what you call green scamming.
Green scamming. And that's what's going on. And so instead of people realizing the consequences of an SUV purchase, the true health impacts of worsening air quality, more asthma among children, are not connected to that purchase decision. They're excited by the billions in spending commercials showing how exciting driving one of these is.
Driving up pristine, green, beautiful mountains. I want to turn once more to Washington, D.C. to invite Fred Smith into our conversation. He's president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a former analyst for the Environmental Protection Agency. Good evening and welcome, Fred Smith.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Brent. How are you doing?
Hi, Fred.
Welcome, Fred. Fred, Christy Todd Whitman is on her way out. She's had a rough time of it. You've heard some of the conversation tonight. Where do you think the argument stands in Washington today on the most effective way to deal positively with environmental issues, market or, as we've heard it described, command and control?
Well, I think the most dramatic thing we need to do is to recognize that for 30 years we've been doing the same thing on a Republican and Democrat in the House, in the Senate. For the first time in the Congress now, we have outside of the green establishment people, Inhofe in the Senate, Pombo in the House. We need someone in the administration who can bring environmental policy into the 21st century, not keep doing the same stupid things we've been doing for 30 years.
So are you saying Christy Todd Whitman was not that person and good riddance?
Well, she wasn't that person, and she's gone, so I think speak no evil of the departed.
Yes.
I think basically what we have got in the environmental field is a program that started out addressing haystack problems.
What do you mean by that?
Sewage floating in rivers, mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands of tons of crude pollutant coming out of a few hundred smokestacks.
Mm-hmm.
Those first haystack problems have largely been addressed. We've made dramatic progress in those style problems. The ones that are left are highly localized. They're no longer talking about haystacks. You're talking in needles in the haystacks, and yet we still persist in doing everything out of Washington, doing it with no trade-offs, doing it with no subtlety at all.
And you're saying
it
can't be done with a top-down approach, but we're hearing tonight from Brent Blackwelder that the so-called market approach ends up being a cover for retreat or doing nothing.
Well, I think Brent and I might actually have an agreement here. Markets aren't about more green taxes and more green energy rationing or rationing coupons.
Mm.
They're about devolution, letting local people make local decisions about where they think their green dollars ought to go to achieve green achievements. We're talking about essentially recognizing the dramatic role that private property could play in protecting waters, protecting groundwaters, particularly protecting wildlife. You don't have to assume that environmental, you don't have to be a red to be a green.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of ways in which the environment can be protected by you and I protecting the properties and extend property rights to some of the things that are greatly at risk because they're just managed as a commons, politically mismanaged commons.
Brent Blackwelder, are you on board? Are you ready to, chop down the EPA and go for devolution?
No, I mean, we can't return to the 1800s because we saw what happened if you just totally deregulated business. But one of the key areas where we have some agreement, I think, is in the fact that we should not be subsidizing energy sources, and yet the ones that get the biggest subsidies are the old-time fossil fuel industry.
Well, let's go complete free enterprise here.
Let's get rid of all the subsidies. Fred Smith, let us hear from you across the board.
Let's get rid of all of them. Let's get rid of wind subsidies, nuclear subsidies, coal subsidies, renewable subsidies, ethanol subsidies.
Exactly.
The world would work much better if we weren't trying to play winners and losers in the energy game.
Fred, let me ask you this. If you do that, what keeps the whole situation from going back to 18th, 19th century economics and clear cutting and all the rest?
Well, What goes to it is the fact that we just had Bjorn Lomborg, the skeptical environmentalist, the Danish guy who's making all kinds of waves in the environmental field. He's pointed out that when resources are integrated into a system of property rights, as they get scarce, their price goes up. People go out and worry about them, whether it's clean water, whether the thing is, in the environmental field, we have been intellectually bankrupt. We have left resources like rivers, like groundwater, like wildlife out in the cold. The only one to protect them is a political bureaucracy, which is not that competent.
But I want to put the same question, because, of course, there were many resources which were drawn all the way down to nearly to zero. And concern about that.
No resource that is in the market system has ever gone down to zero. None.
But virgin forests have gone down to pretty close to zero.
Virgin forest, of course. When we landed in the United States, we chopped down an awful lot of trees. But in America, we turned those chopped down trees into wealth and to technological change, and now in the United States, the last 50, 60, 70 years, we've found a dramatic increase in forestry to the point where the average person walking in many eastern woods thinks he's in a virgin forest.
But I'm still not sure I get it. Are you saying that awareness of the value of different environmental factors has grown sufficiently so that if we have a more free market dynamic here, we won't repeat the kind of environmental degradation of the late 19th, early 20th century?
Something a little more radical than that. We're saying that had we allowed property rights to evolve in the 19th century, as resources became valuable, groundwater, as wildlife became more valuable, clean water, clean air became more valuable, had we allowed property rights to emerge and property rights defenses, liability rules to emerge, we would be much further ahead than we are today. Instead, we froze that process. The progressive era came in and said, hey, the goal of society is to produce more wealth, not to produce more choices for individuals to do with what they wish their property. We essentially overrode environmental considerations for the first half of the progressive era. Then when the disasters occurred, we blamed the market. Markets didn't fail. We sabotaged market forces.
John Dineen, I want to bring you in here. How widespread, how deeply felt or believed is Fred Smith's view in the U.S. Congress?
I think you've just been listening to a real crystallization of the debate within Congress. The fight over property rights, in many respects, the real ideological battle over the past 2 years or so of the Bush administration is not being fought in the Environmental Protection Agency, but in the Department of the Interior.
Because?
Because, one, Western lands are where property rights have become a huge issue and have been for years. There's been bitter opposition by many Western lawmakers to the degree of control that the federal government assumes over property out there, because, of course, the federal government controls so much of it.
Massive swaths. Fred Smith, I want to put one more question to you. I hear what you're saying, but isn't it a huge roll of the dice? What if we bet the environment on this approach and it doesn't work? At least with top down, you have some idea what the bottom line is, don't you?
Well, you don't really. I mean, after all, as Brent said earlier, we have spent billions of dollars in Superfund, and I think very few people, green establishment, free market people, would argue that Superfund has been anything other than a waste of money. Pouring more money into that rat hole would do nothing at all except make consultants and lawyers rich. What we've got to recognize is that insanity is keeping doing things that haven't worked very well just because you don't have any other ideas. There are dramatic amounts of ideas out there. Look at the developing world. We found out that poverty is the greatest cause of pollution. So economic growth is not incompatible with environmental protection. It's essential if we're going to protect the planet.
You got us going a mile a minute here, and we appreciate it. Thanks for joining us tonight.
No problem.
Fred Smith is president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We're talking about Christy Todd Whitman and the environmental impact of the Bush administration. You can join the conversation. How strongly do you want the federal government protecting the environment? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Christy Todd Whitman and the environmental impact of the Bush administration. We're hearing that it's coming down to a super high-stakes debate once again between regulation and markets, with the fate of the environment hanging in the balance. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. My guests are Brent Blackwelder, president of Friends of the Earth, and John Dineen, editor of Congressional Green Sheets, an independent publishing company that provides information on congressional action on environment, energy, and natural resources. Mary's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks so much for facilitating this discussion. And my comment is, earlier when you were talking about the the possible appointees. You mentioned someone from, I guess, a vehicle lobbyist of some sort.
As a potential successor to Christy Todd Whitman, yes, Josephine Cooper.
Yeah, and both of you went, in this really ominous way, and so did I. And
well,
it
does get your attention.
Needs to be articulated a little bit.
Good. Yeah, we'll elaborate on that, Mary. Thanks for calling. John Dineen, what can you tell us about Josephine Cooper? She's Chief Operating Officer of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. It does not sound at first blush like a green candidate for the head of the EPA.
No, Joe Cooper has been in Washington for years and years. If I recall correctly, she may have been an EPA at one point.
I think she was. But is this a hallmark of Bush years that you put the automobile manufacturers in charge of the hen house?
Well, I think the question is really what programs is she going to be implementing? Christy Todd Whitman was seen as a moderate Republican from New Jersey, and no one would argue, at least her advocates at that time would have said, these are not the policies she would have pursued on her own. So,
are you saying she might step out of her automobile lobbyist role and turn into a green EPA chief?
I think the question is where are the question that was raised by Christy Todd Whitman when she took over. One of the initial problems she ran into, she went overseas to meet with the environment ministers and announced that the United States would meet its commitments on global warming.
And we did not.
And the next week we renounced the Kyoto Treaty. That sort of set Christy Whitman, that sort of defined the terms of Christy Whitman's term in office. One, was she in the loop? And two, who was making environmental decisions if she was not? If they were being made at the White House, what is different by having a Joe Cooper, someone from the automobile industry?
So you're saying at least it would be somebody in the loop, and we've got that picture. But my, what an interesting resume entry. I want to get one more call. Zig is calling from Newton Highlands, Massachusetts. Hi, Zig.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. Our time is short, Zig. What's your question or point?
Well, first of all, it's great that you and the media are paying attention to this because this assault has mostly not been picked up by the papers. There was something that you haven't mentioned, though.
Yes.
Although, Brent, hi, Brent.
Hi.
May have mentioned it before I got on. We've been talking about changing in the legislation and also proposed regulations, but a lot has been going on in this administration in a way that we've never seen before.
Take it to us quick, Zig. The clock is really moving on me here.
Collusive capitulation. You get the industry to attack the regulation, and then you send in not just the Interior lawyers but the Department of Justice lawyers, and they say, Your Honor, we're either not appearing to defend this regulation, or we think this regulation's bad.
So you go to the courts to get things cut right out of the law.
And then, surprise, surprise, the court, because the regulation isn't being defended, it finds against the regulation, and the administration says, oh, we've got a bad regulation, we won't enforce it anywhere in the country.
And poof, it's gone. Zig, thanks for raising it. Brent Blackwelder, we've just got a minute here, but is that a significant factor in what's going on with the environment today?
Absolutely. In fact, we're likely to see more and more of the fox guarding the hen house syndrome. The air in the cities is going to get worse. You won't be able to take your kids fishing. If you do, because you catch the fish, they will have too much mercury content. You won't be able to eat them. You'll have fish advisories. So we are going backwards. We are looking at a major hypocrisy, major catering to special interests. They're free enterprise for the polluters, actually subsidizing them in the energy bill. We've got to actually shift away from this kind of thinking. We should think, what is best for our children, for the future? Are we really improving the air and water, or are we catering to special polluting interests?
Well, we're going to be watching closely, and watch out for those market forces. Brent, you're going to be sold those again, I have a feeling. Thanks for joining us tonight. Brent Blackwelder is president of Friends of the Earth, and John Dineen, editor of Congressional Green Sheets. Thanks very much for being with us, to you both. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, God returns to the silver screen. This is On Point. American religion is firmly committed to the notion of a gracious rather than a punitive God, writes theologian Andrew Greeley. He goes on, God in the movies is someone who supports and sustains American optimism. In Hollywood, the Almighty has come a long way since the earth-shaking voice of the invisible God in the Ten Commandments. In the irreverent American worldview, the role of God is the realm of George Burns, Alanis Morissette, and now Morgan Freeman in the new Jim Carrey film, Bruce Almighty.
I bet you're wondering why you're here. I brought a hit off your job.
Who are you?
Bruce, I'm God. When you leave this building, you will be endowed with all my powers.
On Point's movie maven, Garen Daly, joins me now with a look at the evolution of the creator on the silver screen. Welcome, Garen.
Hi, Tom.
So here we are back at the movies. God's the subject. What's up with the big guy?
Well, the big guy is there to help us when we need him. And he seems to always be in the back seat when we don't. But if you take a look at Bruce Almighty, which is coming out, Morgan Freeman, who I believe is, you know, right now is the perfect guy to play God. He's got that regal bearing, that wonderful voice. And when you look at this film, as well as other films in which God is in, you want to take a look at actually who is portraying the entity, who's playing the deity.
Now, yeah. In Morgan's case, he's got that deep voice. I see him here all decked out in a white suit.
Yeah.
And the bearing you talked about.
And the bearing. But, you know, not only is he in the white suit and in the bearing, he also plays a janitor, which is a very interesting way of kind of depicting God in this large, empty warehouse. He is cleaning the floors. He's changing the light bulbs. He's kind of cleaning up our messes. And that's what this whole film is about. And it's really very, very funny. And it's a wonderful Jim Carrey film with some hilarious moments. I think, though, the people who are going to see this film are going to have a slightly unsettling view of what religion has to do with Jim Carrey and his relationship to God.
How does it end up being unsettling?
Well, because he becomes God. He has all of God's powers. And he messes it up, and because it's so overpowering and so difficult of a job, he has to end up releasing his ego and getting on his knees and begging God's forgiveness. I think people are going to have a little bit of a hard time with Jim Carrey on his knees asking for forgiveness.
Take us back. It wasn't always so prosaic. It wasn't always a guy in a suit who could be walking down the street. God in the movies, I don't know, if we go back to the Ten Commandments, at one time was just a voice.
But not just a voice. He was a burning bush, or he was some sort of manifestation. He was not human at all. Morgan Freeman is human. In the Ten Commandments, Charlton Heston playing Moses goes up on the mountain and sees a burning bush. And in that burning bush, the voice of God comes out.
When thou hast brought forth the people, they shall serve me upon this mountain. I will put my laws into their hearts.
But if I say to your children that the God of their fathers has sent me, they will ask, what is his name? And how shall I answer them?
I am that I am.
God and the Ten Commandments, 1956. This is an invisible, all-powerful, very stern Almighty.
It's a stern Almighty who's telling you that your only way through salvation is by towing the line with his laws, and salvation is only accomplished through fear and intimidation. A far different view than what we see with Morgan Freeman or some of the other gods that we see in movies.
And a different character than we had even seen in some earlier movies.
That's right, yeah. If you go back to the 1946 It's a Wonderful Life, which was everyone knows as George Bailey, God starts off very early on there, and his physical representation is not a burning bush, but a galaxy in the cosmos.
Jimmy Stewart looks up into the night sky and God twinkles.
Yes. Everyone's praying for George to be saved, and God hears him, and he talks to Joseph about redeeming George Bailey.
Hello, Joseph. Trouble?
Looks like we'll have to send someone down. A lot of people asking for help for a man named George Bailey.
George Bailey? Yes, tonight's his crucial night. You're right. We'll have to send someone down immediately. Whose turn is it?
That's why I came to see you, sir. It's a clockmaker's turn again.
Oh, Clarence hasn't got his wings yet, has he?
We've passed him up right along. Because, you know, sir, he's got the IQ of a rabbit.
Yes, but he's got the faith of a child. Simple. Joseph, send for Clarence.
The Hollywood God of 1946 and It's a Wonderful Life, paternal, gentle, redeeming, patient.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about the redeeming. Not only is George Bailey going to be redeemed, but Clarence gets redeemed. And I think if we look at the fact that this is a post-World War II film, I think Frank Capra, as director, is saying, we as a nation, we as a culture are looking to be redeemed after the horrors of World War II.
very gentle, but still within his power to do just about anything. Years later, we always see God. I mean, he is now always personified.
He is personified. And in 1977, we came along with Oh God with George Burns. And I remember when this came out, I said, George Burns is the perfect representation of God for that particular time. But God is no longer the burning bush or the galaxy beaming at the gentle paternalism. He has now become someone who is not really threatening our lives.
You're Johnny Appleseed. You drop a few seeds and you move on. The seeds are good, they'll take root. I gave you great seeds, the best.
I lost my job, you know.
There are other cities, other supermarkets.
Everybody thinks I'm a nut.
Galileo, Pasteur, Einstein, Columbus. You're in good company. Hold on.
George Burns is God humoring John Denver in 1977's Oh God. It kind of figures who shows up as God. In 1972, it was Peter O'Toole. There's a certain kind of actor who emerges, who's put forward as God.
Yeah, and this is a wonderful black comedy that says a lot about society, its relation with God, as well as what was happening at the time in the late 60s and the 70s.
That is the ruling class, the 72 picture.
72 ruling class film. In the film, he plays this landed aristocrat whose father has died in a bizarre death, and he has to take over the estate. And there's all these hangers-on, and they are absolutely crazed because this guy is an absolute nut. He is crazy. He thinks he's God.
Is he presented as God or just a delusional human?
He's presented as a delusional human, but the fact is that we are now thinking of ourselves no longer as, you know, God being out there, but God is inside ourselves, that he's a gentle soul who is a little bit loony, who may have some God inside himself. And the reason he thinks he's God is because when he prays, he thinks he's talking to himself.
How do you know you're God?
Simple. When I pray to him, I find I'm talking to myself.
I see. Well, how did it happen? How did you come to be in this state of grace?
Like every prophet, I saw visions, heard voices, I ran. But the voices of St. Francis, Socrates, General Gordon, and Timothy O'Leary all told me I was God.
Where did all this happen?
East Acton, outside the public urinal.
Peter O'Toole, 1972, in the ruling class, and oh, that is so 1972. Karen, there's another one on your list. I have to admit, haven't seen it. Dogma, 1999 with Alanis Morissette. But here, God is she.
Well, God is she, but this is Kevin Smith in a very revisionistic look. He took a lot of heat from the right, you know, Catholic wing of religion because it was revisionistic. But if you take a look at it, there's a lot of the fire and brimstone in it. There's a lot of the forgiveness in it.
What's the characterization that Alanis Morissette
gave? Alanis Morissette plays God. She is a mute, playful, fashion-challenged God who is trying to prevent two angels from entering this building and thus creating the ultimate disaster. At the end, she is approached by Linda Fiorentino, who is playing this kind of Mary character and who has that question that we're always asking.
There is one I need to ask, and I'm sure you get it all the time. How many opportunities like this will I ever get? Why are we here?
What Alanis Morissette does to Linda Fiorentino is the answer to the question. She takes her nose and just tweaks it a little bit. You know, it's like we don't really know because we're not capable of winning, but it's a joke and we should enjoy the joke because life is fun. And that's what Kevin Smith is saying in this film.
So, Garen, Hollywood gives us the God we need at the moment that particular film comes out?
I think that maybe not so much that we need, but it may more like reflect what we are thinking about as God at that point. If we take a look at, you know, George Burns being frail and old and not imposing on ourselves, and Alanis Morissette being this kind of very strong matriarchal person, and then who knows what the next one is going to be like for us. But I think it reflects what we are thinking about God at that particular time.
And so Morgan Freeman right now says what?
He is a CEO who manages to clean up our messes.
The janitor and CEO Morgan Freeman, also Lord Almighty. Garen Daly, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is artistic director at the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's Movie Maven.
I've got the power!
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.